Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Hi there, this is Christoph Goes. You'll be listening to new tracks from my new album Turning Inside right here on BBS Radio, because if it's...
And I want to, I have a happy birthday here. My dog, Athena, is celebrating her 8th anniversary right now as we speak. So she is a very special gift from heaven, I have to say. She saved my life more than once, and she's a fantastic human being. She happens to walk on all fours. That's about the only difference. She's a gorgeous golden retriever, and she's very telepathic, very musically oriented, and she only eats what she doesn't want around. So people ask, does she bite? And I say, only when I tell her to. We have a special guest with us. It's going to be his first time on Evident Footprints. And I actually made communication with him first via an email that he sent to network. And I went and checked out his web space at myspace.com, and found it very interesting. He's an excellent musician and an author, a writer of sorts. He writes actually different kinds of stuff. And when we talked about what we might discuss on tonight's show, there were just so many things that we could talk about that I just left it open for discussion. And of course, as usual, we invite you to come to bbsradio.com if you're not listening online, and check out the numbers. I'll give out some call-in numbers a little while later on, and you might have some questions or want to get involved in the discussion. I want to do more of that as the days go on and involve the listening audience in what we're talking about. We touch on a lot of issues, and just because I have a musician here doesn't mean that he doesn't know what's going on in the world. Of course, you know I'm a musician. Many of us are, actually, and that gives us an extra edge in discernment, I think, because of the amount of discipline that we put into learning a musical instrument and learning to perform in public and communicate with people. Music is a very high form of communication. We tend to find out that if we have spiritual gifts and we have discernment, we kind of pay attention to what's going on. We get a lot of our inspiration from what is going on in the world and understanding it and communicating that to people. That's why so many people like music, and why they like musicians, or why they like singers or songwriters. And so tonight we're bringing on another fellow musician. He is from the Houston, Texas area, and plays a number of instruments. I know he plays bass real well. I got to hear him play bass, and I can tell you he is motivated in part by Stanley Clarke. He's got really good bass chops. I'm speaking about tonight's guest, Mr. Kenny Love. Kenny, how are you this evening?
Hey, how are you doing, Don? Great to be here.
I'm doing good, but I'm going to have to ask our engineer to turn your volume up because I can barely hear you.
Okay.
Okay, so make sure you're speaking close to the phone. I know you know how to talk.
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm on. How is that going?
It's getting a little better.
Okay.
It's getting a little better.
Okay.
I'll trust someone will listen in their headphone mix and see that this level is still a bit low.
Oh, okay.
I heard you say you're doing well. That's good.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
welcome, yeah. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
You and I had a chance, Kenny, to talk about a lot of things, and of course, we talked about music, and we're going to do that tonight. And we talked about some other things, and
mm-hmm.
And I know really your heart is in music, as mine is,
mm-hmm.
And we as fellow musicians, I don't know what your take is, but I was basically explaining to our listening audience that. That we get a lot of our inspiration from what's actually going on in the world, not just personal experiences, but sometimes we use national or worldwide events as the inspiration for lyrics to a song or getting a message out and getting our viewpoint out to bring often a sanity or a peace to situations.
Yeah, the world and its elements are just about the, I would say, 99% of the inspiration for just about every song, whether it's publicly or whether it's personally based. And if you think about it, I mean, you can listen to a song and just about derive it. One of my personal favorite artists is Sting, because he writes so deeply from a lyrical standpoint and from a musical standpoint. And I really like to listen to what he has to say and what he hangs on the edge, so to speak.
Yes. Now that's interesting. You mentioned Sting, because now I haven't worked with Sting, but some of the musicians he has played with, or who have played with him, I should say, his sidemen, Kenny Kirkland, the late Kenny Kirkland, being one keyboardist, was a good friend of mine and played with me when I was in Europe.
Oh, okay.
So this, as we begin talking about musicians, you know, we're going to run into people who know each other, from these associations.
Right, uh-huh.
I had the opportunity tonight to run into a guitar player with whom I played along with Little Anthony and the Imperials.
Oh, really?
A couple of years ago, yeah. And we both look a little bit different. I'm a little bit grayer, and he was a little, his hair was trimmed shorter.
Okay.
But when I heard him play, I said, "You have to be Tony Polizzi." And he said, "Yes, I am." And huh. I mean, you know, his axe gave him away. His style mm-hmm. gave him away.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
So it's a small world.
It is. I believe you had asked me before during our initial conversation, about my bass playing. I basically kind of gave like a little whip remark saying that I just kind of play, I believe that was you I was telling, I just kind of play what I've heard other people play. I try not to say I'm a cultured, classical trained bass player, because that, the classical instrument, my classical instrument is trumpet, but I kind of knocked around on a couple of instruments and kind of became familiar with them, and Stanley Clarke was one of the people that I listened to a lot. In fact, on my MySpace, with that little player that I have on there, his first song is the first one that comes up. He's from his Return to Forever days, if you remember those.
Chick Corea and all those guys. Yeah,
I
remember.
Oh yeah. And that's the kind of stuff I really, when I break down for my music promotion and publicity for other clients, that's kind of what I do. I break down and. My listening areas are the Jaco Pastorius's, the Stanley Clarks, the George Dukes, the Billy Cobhams, all those guys who are really, really off into that stuff. The Crusaders, they're actually from my hometown, Houston.
See, you're hitting you're hitting my nerves there.
I thought I would be on those.
I played with Jaco years ago, too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, back with Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders. So, again, there's another... There's another bullseye.
Jaco has, in fact, on that player, that same player with Stanley Clarke, Jaco has an incredible, and I'm quite sure he did this a lot, although I never bought any of his stuff, but I did listen to it. He has an incredible song that he wrote just on bass harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, with somebody who's a connoisseur of Jaco Pastorius, that he probably did that a lot, but to me, I just heard that... I've heard him do a lot of bass lines with other musicians and stuff and playing songs, but I'd never heard him do harmonics like that. and it was just incredible. I mean, if you can sit there and pick out a bass instrument, bass guitar being what it is and what its purpose is in a song, and for it to be that melodic, you know, just on its own was just incredible to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was a student at Berklee School of Music, and as you well know, you know, this is for the listeners, he was the pioneer of the fretless electric bass.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and when they came out with the Alembic bass, if you remember that one,
right,
and that was the fretless that had the fretboard that lit up.
Oh yeah,
that was an awesome bass, and throughout my career, I ran into a few players who had that instrument, and they were all influenced by Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah, you have to be a very brave person, number one, to even pick up a fretless, because it's just as it says for the listeners, there are no frets, so there are no cheats and there are no guides, you know.
Yeah.
I personally won't even pick up a fretless myself. I would love to, and I may one day in the privacy of my own home. But
mm-hmm.
To actually go out there and perform on it, you know, and expect to do a whole night on it, that's very challenging because you have to actually know where your notes are.
Yes. You have to know your instrument, right?
Yes, you do.
But
you really
the beauty of that instrument is that, you know, the fret gives you a clean, on any really fretted instrument, whether it's a guitar or a banjo or a mandolin or, you know, any instrument with a fret gives you a clean break point for the next note,
yeah.
The next semitone.
Yeah.
And he can play quarter tones or eighth tones, and he can do glissandos and falls with the fingerboard. It's a smooth fingerboard like on a violin or a viola or a cello.
I'll tell you how weird this comparison I'm getting ready to make to that fretless versus the fret and what you just described with Jaco playing. You've had probably a Hershey's bar with almonds, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay, have you also had a Cadbury's chocolate bar?
I've had one of those, too.
Okay. Recall the difference in those, the crunchiness, the bumping around in your mouth with
the
Hershey's
smooth.
Almonds versus the real smooth taste
yeah.
that comes over
exactly.
with the Cadbury's. You know,
yeah.
And that's what you got with Jaco. You got that Cadbury bar.
Okay, we
and you
have
got the
to
rest
send
of us
tape
on,
with this.
Yeah, and you got the rest of us chomping down with the almonds.
Yeah, we'll send a copy yeah. to Hershey's and Cadbury for
that. Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't mean to bring that up like that, though.
No, it's fine. We'll send them a tape. Maybe they'll send us a check.
Maybe they will. That would be nice.
And we could set it to some music, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It'll create a whole new career.
Yes,
anyway,
exactly.
We hate McDonald's and Whataburgers and KFC and all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Kenny, you sent me, you did not send me some music, okay? And so we really can't listen to any of your music tonight, at least the way I'm set up.
Mm-hmm.
But we will have you on in a future show where we just... listen to music, okay, and talk about the things that are going on there.
Okay.
But I thought it would be advantageous, first of all, for you to share your background, how you got where you are right now. You know, who is Kenny Love? What is he all about? And where he's headed.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you this. Kenny Love all started on a little small street as a little angry four-year-old. And that may sound weird, but I'll bring that up to par. What happened to me I'm 50 years old now, okay? But when I started at the age of 46 years ago, it was a direct result of my not being able, of having been given a little miniature trumpet to play in the March of Dimes parade. We're all, you know, when you come out into the parades, we're back on the little side street. And boy, I was just excited. And they had given me the trumpet, and I could not blow it. And they took that thing out of my hand real quick and gave it to another boy who could blow it.
Hmm.
And I tell you, you talk about frustration. I'm still trying to get over that, you know. But what ended up happening was I actually played trumpet. I ended up going on to school and playing trumpet starting in the sixth grade and actually sat first chair during my junior high and my senior high years. I ended up going to college, majoring in music education, still playing trumpet. And by that time, I had picked up bass and I had picked up piano. My aunt actually tried to force me to sit down and play piano during the summers that I was off, but I just didn't have the discipline. But I did pick it up along the way to a degree, and ended up right after that, when Houston, after I got out of the military, I also played in the military bands too, but after I got out of the military, moved back to Houston and started working with bands and that type of thing, and was in some really good original bands. But these guys all had good day jobs, okay? And I was always kind of the kind of person that I kind of followed my heart and followed my what I really liked. And was sort of like that in school. The only thing that really mattered to me was music. But anyway, I'm in Houston with these guys, and I start taking it up on myself to, when we get all our original material together, to start sending out tapes to major labels, and several of them were interested in us. And once these guys saw that, they really kind of got upset about it, because now there it was, you know, it's do or die, make a choice. And so they chose not to go with it. And so I just kind of at that point looked at it, and I said I wasn't going to put my career in the hands of that many people to make a decision for me anymore. And that's what started me on the independent part of my career as a musician. Mm-hmm. Now I had gotten signed by a major label producer by the name of Aubrey Skip Gravitt. He used to be a major label producer, and he worked with MCA Records. I didn't know it at the time, but he is the gentleman credited with the discovery of Evelyn Champagne King. Mm-hmm. He had heard her singing in the studio. I think she was just a cleanup girl or something like that at the time. And he signed her, and we all know the rest of the story from behind her. Yeah. But anyway, unfortunately, Aubrey ended up getting killed through an accident before I was able to go and record my debut album with him out in Philadelphia. And that even spurred me to be even more focused on independency too. And that's where I was. I ended up putting a record out, that single record out, that went national to a degree, and it went international. And in fact, if you're able to ever pull up an old copy of the Cashbox magazine, where they had several major stars in there, Queen Latifah, I can just recall off the top of my head, Ralph Tresvant, I was in that article with him, Brian Adams, when Brian had kind of first come out.
Mm-hmm.
Brian had actually been out about 5 or 6 years by that point, but I was in there, and I ended up having to promote myself and publicize my work and everything, and I sort of used aliases to do that, and it was so much fun, and the business was so much fun, and I got to learn a part of the business that most musicians and recording artists never see and never hear. And I liked the business aspect of it. Here I sit almost 20 years later, having worked with several celebrity clients as a promoter and as a publicist. One of the most famous ones that I've worked with is James Plunkett Branch. That name may mean something to some people, but most people it may not. But he's a jazz saxophonist. If you ever watched the Cosby Show, you've heard James Branch, because mm-hmm. when they would go to all those different scenes and say, "Well, you hear all that jazz saxophonist running," little, that was mm-hmm. James Branch. So that's pretty much one of my stories to where I've arrived at here.
Now, you mentioned Evelyn Champagne King, and I mentioned to you there's a connection there, too, from my days on the East Coast.
Uh-huh, so right.
It's a small world, I'm telling you.
Yes, it is.
And the musicians you mentioned, you know, the Crusaders.
Uh-huh.
We used to spend days, as we traveled on the tour bus across the country, we would listen to all of their albums.
Oh, yeah.
The Jazz Crusaders, and then when they became the Crusaders.
Right.
And learned all the tunes, learned all the riffs, and, you know, whether you're talking about Styx Hooper or Wayne Henderson,
uh-huh.
Wilton Felder,
uh-huh.
Joe Sample.
Uh-huh.
And then when I went to Hollywood, I became a partner with the late Bob Todd. He passed away a few years ago.
Okay.
We were partners for 10.5 years, and we had a studio down the street from A&M Records.
Oh, wow.
And they used to send all their artists to our little 8-track studio to do demos, because we were cutting really clean recordings, and we could do magic with what we had. And we were competing with their Charlie Chaplin studio. And still the A&R people from Alma Irving used to come over and record their artists. And so I got to rub shoulders with a lot of really heavy musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Delaney Bramlett.
Mm-hmm.
From Delaney and Bonnie. And you know, he gave people like Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix their start.
Okay.
So you know, these were some of the guys from the early to mid 60s that were laying the path for certain types of rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and then some of these styles that became fused together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small world, man, I'm telling you.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You mentioned
is.
And we got to work with Welton Felder. He did a lot of our bass tracks.
Oh, okay.
On the stuff that we did. He was doing a lot of session work with us in Hollywood.
Now let me ask you, bringing up Welton Felder, I was just considering him, I was thinking about him the other night, and as I was listening to some of this Crusader stuff, and I don't know what it is about horn players that move to bass guitar specifically. I've noticed that's a trend. I picked it up in high school. I picked up the bass in high school after playing trumpet. A friend of mine who was in a band, his name is Clyde Tovall. Clyde Tovall was a bass player, rather, for a group called Chocolate Milk that had a pretty big album out on MCA back in the early 70s called The Milky Way. Had several albums out, but I think The Milky Way was their biggest. Clyde was played bass on there. Now, Clyde was originally a trumpet player, and then when I thought about Welton Felder, how he was able to do all that moving back and forth, because the Crusaders got to where they were really limited. I forget who the bass. Oh, it was Popwell. Robert Pops Popwell was the bass player. I think the original with them.
Yes.
And he left. He probably was the first one to leave the group. And then I guess Welton picked it up from there. But it was interesting to see Welton go back and forth on each song. Obviously he was multi-tracking, but to play the bass as well as he did, and then play the saxophone. What was your experience like with him on bass guitar?
He was just awesome. He would just go in and you tell him, okay, listen to this track. Now, I have a groove written out for you. But I want you to listen to the track and tell me how you would interpret the groove that I wrote out.
Mm-hmm.
He could take that groove, not change a note, and make it sound like something completely different.
Wow.
He was that kind of player. Now, musically, that doesn't make sense because you play the notes as they're written. But he had a way. Sometimes he used a pick. Sometimes he just used his fingers.
Okay.
But he had a way of setting the EQ on his instrument, and his amp, and he could get this earthy, almost what we would call a raunchy sound, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
A dirty sound, you know, a soulful sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he had perfect time. And you know, a lot of people think, a lot of musicians erroneously think that the drummer is responsible for the tempo.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the bass player that's responsible. And he was a machine.
Wow.
You didn't need to use a click track. And in those days, they were starting to use click tracks just to keep songs from running away, because we were doing a piece of music that had to be done at a specific tempo, so it was done in 58 seconds, you know, or 29 seconds. And
okay.
it was going to be in a commercial, or it was going to be just a sample of something. And and so tempo was very critical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of this way too. I have a built-in clock, and I can tell you what a tempo is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
As if I was holding a metronome in my hand, making a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And Welton is that kind of player.
Hmm.
So that was my experience with him. Perfect intonation, just and just a fun guy to be around, you know. Just just a joy.
Yeah, I've loved all of the Crusaders' works. I guess my favorite album is probably "Free as the Wind."
Oh,
the
yes,
one, the one that's got the windmill on it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, and the kind of rustic coloring on it. I mm-hmm. love every song on that album. Every song.
Yeah.
River Rat. The way we was instead mm-hmm. of the way we were.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Put it where you want it.
That
maybe one of their most famous tunes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember Larry Carlton being there the first time I ever, not to get off on the Crusaders per se, but I remember the first thing that struck me about them, well, the first thing, finding out they were from Houston, but also finding out that seeing Larry Carlton was a part of them, too, at one point.
Mm-hmm.
He was their guitar player.
Yeah.
And they took this photo where they were like the knights from over in Old Britain, and they had to, you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That cover where they, mm-hmm. all of them were wearing like the knight armor and all that, and they had the big long table sitting out there, the knights around the table and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that just really got me in. And that actually got me into focusing on concepts for album covers. I don't know what it is about musicians today, but almost everybody just does a photo session. It's like they lose creativity when it comes to anything outside of the music. You know, and I've tried to get people through the years. You know, one thing I want to plug here is my B-Sharp newsletter for all the musicians. it's an instructional newsletter, and it's absolutely free. But I use that to teach and instruct and advise. And I've been publishing it. This is my eighth year, and it has over 2,000 musicians subscribed to it. But the thing about it is that got me into the concept album and the concept, the visual concept, such as Ohio Players when they put out the album called Fire, and they had the girl with the fireman's hat on, and they had the fire hose wrapped around her. And I've tried to tell musicians this for years. Listen, you got a lot of people. You got a lot of people who are going to see your product before they ever hear it. Don't you want something to stop them in their tracks and attract them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and make them pick it up. But today it seemed like it's gotten worse. You know, people are just taking photos. They're sitting down, and I'm like, what is this? Nobody knows what it's about. You're sitting there in a chair. You know, I even wrote an article that was a fictional piece based on a detective that was trying to find out why the band's, the mystery is called the mystery of the great mystery of the CD, something like that. I forgot the title. But it's about a detective on a case trying to find out why a band's CD is not selling. And it's humorous and everything, but it strikes a chord, you know, as to why people don't no longer do that. No longer do that. Now, I almost, the only thing I can attribute it to is the small size of the CD cover compared to when you could really come up with a picturesque painting, almost, if you will, when there were the albums that were coming out and the album size covers.
Yeah, you know, when I think of different artists, you know, Stevie Wonder had a unique type of graphics that usually became a pattern of what he released after. What was it? Fingertips was his first big hit, and then.
Right.
When he came out with, like, Songs in the Key of Life,
mm-hmm.
and The Secret Life of Plants, and
mm-hmm.
as he came out with more albums, he had pictures done. Now, what was interesting is the way he was able to always come up with something that was appropriate for the music, and,
mm-hmm.
and keeping in mind that he's blind.
Right. Right.
And not to mention how he wrote, I mean, his lyrics. Now, he wasn't blind from birth, but he went blind, I think, at age 4.
Right.
So he was shortchanged a lot of things. And,
right.
And yet his lyrics are the most creative lyrics I think I've ever heard of any songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
When he's writing his really serious music. And that one album, Songs in the Key of Life, I think that one and The Secret Life of Plants, those two albums were some of his best work. And,
yeah.
And every one was a masterpiece, but
yeah.
But those two in particular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you know there are some artists out there, and I'm not trying to disagree with what you're saying. I do agree with what you're saying. You know, it's more image than content.
Right.
It's more how you can market this
right.
than letting the music carry it.
Right. Which has actually gotten us to where we are, the deplorable condition that the music industry is in as a whole today.
Yes.
Overall, that is a big and a major contribution to that. So, you know, and now the people in the industry and behind the industry are complaining about it, but, you know, the industry did it to itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate, but it is, and now they got to deal with it.
Well, you know, you're right. You know, they made their own bed, and they say they don't want to sleep in it, but
mm-hmm.
They shortchanged artists.
Right.
Or you know, most people don't know this, that an artist on the average, starting out, got, if he was lucky, he got 2%, maybe 2.5% of all the royalties. Now, the record label would say something like, well, we fronted all the money for the production expenses and the post-production and the pressing and the marketing. Once they get into marketing, this is where they have these costs that are just exorbitant. They would put millions of dollars, and they do this today. They spend millions of dollars promoting a product, not really insisting that the product is the highest quality.
Right.
When you go back to the days of Stax Records or East Memphis,
mm-hmm.
and I was connected with that also.
Okay.
So watch out. or Columbia, you know, Epic. They had labels within the whole major label, and they had people like Clive Davis running the company. Well, they had all the best groups. They had Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and they had Chicago, and they had Miles Davis and Frank Sinatra all across the board.
Right.
They had name. You know, Barbra Streisand, Mahalia Jackson, they had well-known singers, well-known groups, the best of the best.
And all incredible artists, regardless of genre.
Yes, and then somehow as other companies came in to buy out these companies and take over their business, and they revamped or they restructured everything, and it became even more artist-unfriendly.
Right,
and many artists found that even though they had contracts that maybe guaranteed them five albums in 5 years or five albums in a year, they were not able to come to terms that they had established themselves and that they were worth more money than they were being paid.
I thought it was always interesting to see, you know. Completely unrelated organizations buying up the music industry and buying the record industry and that type of thing. I think the most recent one, in fact, I believe I may have sent you, at least I intended to send you a notice that said Clorox was now entering the music business. Well, you said we can say anything and it's not censored. So I said, okay, now we'll really get the third degree burns. I'm like, Clorox in the music industry. Come on, man. How diverse can you become, you know? But it just proves a point, you know. It's on its lowest end again, and so now it's up for grabs, kind of like those stocks have deep dipped down low enough for everybody to afford them. Now everybody goes in and grabs them, regardless of the interest, you know.
Well, there was a point when the Steinway Piano Company was bought out by Columbia, and Columbia was taken over by Sony, so they ended up owning Steinway, and they didn't know anything about pianos, and for about 5 years, the company went down the tubes.
Wow.
And they ended up getting the company back, basically, and getting all the original master craftsmen to come back. But see, these people that really know the business don't want to mess with these Johnny-come-latelys that... that really don't understand the music.
Oh, yeah.
I alluded to you that my friend Bob and Lester Sill, who used to run Screen Gems Music, opened some doors for me, and I really, you know, I was trying to get my head in the door, so to speak, or my foot in the door, to start writing, you know, maybe some movie scores or some album projects, something like that, for some up and coming artists, and write some songs. So they set up a meeting with me with this young executive. This guy was probably younger than me. I'd say he was 20, 21 years old, and he's the head of the publishing group for, you know, the recording industry at Chapel Music, the world's largest music publisher.
Wow.
The guy plays a song for me after I played tapes for him. Now, these were tapes that I made in Europe. Some of the tapes, I had Keith Emerson playing keyboard on one of the tracks. Mina singing, a famous Italian singer. Luca Sardelli, also from Italy. Vico Torriani, Umberto Maggi. Umberto and I worked in a studio in Modena, Italy together. And we worked at Tsar Records in Milan, and I worked with all these famous producers and people, and I had tons and tons of high-quality TV radio orchestration and arrangements and all these really sophisticated productions and really good songs that were doing well in Europe. And the guy pulls out a cassette tape, and he plays this thing. These guys are singing 999 over and over and over. That was the lyric to the song. And he said, now that's a hit.
Oh, man.
Now that was in 1982. Have you heard the song yet? And
no.
Here we are, 2008.
No, I certainly haven't. I certainly haven't, and we probably won't at this point.
No.
And I wonder where the young man is at this point.
I haven't heard of him either. But I realized that that 999 is 666 upside down.
you know, I was just getting ready to say that. I said, I actually probably have heard of a title of 666. I'm quite sure with some of the metal guys. But 999, it'll lose me. Man.
It was one of the worst songs I ever heard in my life. But this is what we're up against. You see, this guy knew nothing about what he was hearing.
Yeah.
He knew nothing about my ability, nothing about my training, nothing about my creativity, nothing. And it was his intention not to learn anything, you see.
You know, that is the utter frustration of people who have been classically trained in music to come through and, you know, like, some of them, I'll remain nameless on these, but you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. You spend all your years formally training on instruments, and then you pops these guys who are just clueless. They don't know an A sharp from a A sharp major from a D minor 9, and up pops these guys who come out with these recordings, and they are multimillionaires overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very frustrating. I have a cousin who's a Hollywood actor as well. He has 7 years of drama, okay, formal education. Went to Purdue A&M University for his bachelor's. Went to New York University for his other 3 years, his master's. And gets out in Hollywood, and he's done some really incredible movies. I mean, he's done some stuff. But he is nowhere near some of these guys who came straight off the street and you know, with no training, barely an acting class, if that, and now they're like leading stars in cinema. So I know that's got to be extreme. I've never really sat down and talked to him about it, per se, but I know it's got to be extremely frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
And that's,
yeah,
that's the equivalent of what we go through in the music industry.
Yes. You know, my partner, Bob Todd, had discovered Carol King and Kenny Loggins and James Taylor, and he had them writing in the record company, he and I think some of this writing was for Screen Gems, some of it was for ABC Dunhill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is going way back. And a lot of these songs would get placed in movies, or if there was an up and coming artist, you know, they might make it big. Well, they all ended up recording their own music eventually, but they were making $300 a week, sitting there turning out 10 songs a day, and writing the lead sheets, you know, writing the lyrics, writing the chords, the melodies. And, you know, the correct way of doing it. Then they had to go into the studio, and they had to put together a demo tape so that the A&R people and the people in the publishing wing of the label could listen to these songs and say, hey, this would be a great song for Elvis Presley, or this would be a great song for, you know, whomever. And and they all ended up making their own mark.
Right,
that was the golden days of recording, you know, when people were just writing music.
Right.
But it's become something, in terms of the power that these companies have to make careers of people, they can take anybody off the street, and I don't want to mention names, but I mean, I've seen these people out begging on the street, and then the next thing you know, they're on a nationwide concert tour. They were freaky enough looking, and their lives were so dysfunctional that it's exactly what they wanted to put out there, to have the masses absorb this mind control. And a lot of it has to do with the intentions of the Illuminati. It has nothing to do with the art form.
Oh yeah, I know.
Everything to do with the control. Now, you see this. In sports, in professional sports, music has become a side entertainment to keep to capture the attention and to drive the mood and control the mood of this mass of people that are gathered in a stadium or in an arena to witness a sporting event. And I noticed that all the professional basketball venues, for example, play music that has been recorded by people who have been convicted of pedophilia or who are promoting a homosexual lifestyle. And they get them to write these chants that the crowd claps their hands to and stomps their feet. And people do this. Now, it's just music, but what they don't realize is that they're being mind controlled.
Right.
The whole process is a mind control.
Right.
Why do they pay millions of dollars to the athletes for what they do? It's a way to divert attention. So here we have now the prostitution of music for another purpose, which is totally different from why you or I or any other serious musician chose music as a profession.
Right.
And I know that's very disheartening, and it can make us angry, too.
Oh, yeah, and does.
Yes.
Oh yeah, and you know, when you were, as you were saying that and mentioning the games, I had an even more focused idea on think about the wrestling and the wrestlers, how they come out and all the music and all the big show, and I just but they're blatant with theirs, but it's incredible. It's incredible how the music plays a big part of it, everything in the big imagery. And all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's I I listen to it for a completely different reason. I like to say that that my experience with music is, I was telling you that when I learned to write inversions and chord inversions and jazz inversions and things like that, I think some of us, particularly classically trained musicians, go to a deeper level than even most musicians, because a lot of people pick up the guitar for ulterior motives. A lot of them think, I want to get the girls, I want to make a lot of money. Well, I got into it personally because of the emotionalism and psychology behind music. Music became a real heart string for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can write chords or hear chords or hear certain turns and passages that actually bring tears to my eyes, really. And when I learned how to write those chords and arrange music like that. It was really a whole unique experience for me.
Yes. Well, now, that's funny that you mentioned that, because my path in music, although I still write music for listening pleasure or inspiration, maybe even, you know, I would like to think that my music can have a spiritual message.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing some promos for BBS Radio, which are kind of funny. You and I were talking about parodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm also working on the healing application of music.
Mm-hmm.
And actually some doors are opening up, not just recording-wise, but also where I can actually put this to work in an environment where this is sorely needed.
Yeah.
By people who have disabilities and have been struggling, and modern medicine has not provided the answers.
Right.
Basically, they wring their hands and throw them up in the air and say, "We don't know what to do."
Right. Right.
Which is not even the truth, but.
Mm-hmm.
Now you mentioned to me that you're also very much into parodies, and I find that kind of interesting. I don't know if you got to hear my Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, I was listening to a piece of it there. You got some good stuff. Where you can most readily see mine? You know, I was just talking to a couple of friends the other day as well. I said a lot of people. You know, a lot of comedians go out and they have the gift of gab and they can play off this. I'm the exact opposite. I sit down and I write mine out. And I've sent you a couple of articles I think you one of you got a kick out of.
Oh,
but,
yeah,
but,
yeah.
I sit there and I think about what I want to say and I go back and I edit it. And it takes a lot of pressure off of me because
mm-hmm.
there are things that... That are very frustrating in life and in the world every day that you just can't go out there and do things about, you know, and without serving a little unrequited time in, you know, federal prison XYZ.
Yeah.
So you sit there, and a friend of mine and I were discussing why a lot of people, and now I must say here, too, I'm a former police officer. This is in one of my lives that I lived. I'm a former police officer. I worked. I'm a former prison correctional officer two times, and I'm a former Army sergeant. And we were talking about how and why people get caught up in jams, you know, prison jams, and
music jams,
huh?
Not music jams.
No, not music jams. Now, they may do music jams after they're incarcerated because they don't have anything else to do with their time. But
uh-huh.
in this particular case, we're talking about prison jams.
Okay.
And one of the things we thought about was because people get so emotional, it's something happening. You know, it's something happening, and it's something usually embarrassing, and it's usually too many people around watching this embarrassing thing happen to them. And so they have to react to it to save their manhood or their womanhood. And so this is what happens, and this is why people get caught up. But me, on the other hand, and we were talking about this, and we said, well, the reason we have managed to stay out of prison so far is because we think it through a little bit longer. You know, we think about the consequences. And
yeah.
me having actually worked as a cop and worked as a prison official, I know firsthand where I do not want to go, okay, and for what reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we sit there and we were talking about it. And he said, "Well," I said, "Well, my outlet is writing, whether that be music or whether that be fiction, literary fiction or whatever, you know." And usually when I've written something, whether it is music or whether it is fiction, I've actually taken care of myself. I've saved a lot of money with the psychiatrist and the psychologist, and I've actually come away feeling a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So. I guess that's the fortune. I guess a lot of people don't have those outlets, you know, and it's unfortunate that they don't. But I basically said all that to say this, and to get back what you're saying, it is a healing. It is a great healing, and I don't think it's respected enough for its healing properties.
Mm-hmm.
Music or writing, and a lot of people sit there and say, "Oh, you're just playing around. That's not a viable vocation. You need to be going to be a really be justified citizen of society. You need to be going out to work for somebody every day. That's how you earn your keep, and that's how we can recognize you as a tax-paying citizen." they are, you know, music and the literary arts in general are just so discounted. You know, it's almost like a play toy. You know, nobody, you know, unless you're involved in it like we are, most people don't take it seriously to that degree.
Yeah, you're bringing up a valid point, which reminds me that music in the movie industry is used as sort of a psychological glue, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
to bring emotion and visual images and speech,
right.
to a place where the music sort of evokes the feeling that they want to come out.
Right, exactly.
And don't they use that in commercials?
Yes.
Don't they use that in presenting their message to us?
Yes. And think about your favorite, any one of your favorite horror films. You know, you're cringing on the edge of your seat when that door's creaking open, and you know, what are they playing? Dun, 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 dun. You know, the Michael Myers, the Halloweens, the Jasons, and Friday the 13th, you know, all that music. If it wasn't for the music, we could get and go in there and not worry about coming out and getting slashed up.
And, you know, I used to yell at Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween 1 and say, don't you hear the music? Run.
Yeah, you and I both did that. We were like, can't you see it? Don't go in there. Don't you know? And I hate the ones that they're leaving and they're escaping, and one always has to turn around and go look and see if he's still back there.
Yeah, exactly.
I said, you ought to get slashed. Man, yeah, no, it's just amazing. It's amazing. And, you know, I told you about my litmus test, didn't I? You know, that little interchange I got on a forum with this guy who was going back and forth. He's
an expert. That was hilarious.
Oh, man, he's going to tell the world. He's not even in the music industry. This is what they ought. They ought not to make money from their music. They ought to go out and find something else to sell. I said, they did find something else to sell. It's called music. but he wanted to go back and forth with this deal, and I said, listen, guy. I said, the point is, these artists, with all this file sharing and ripoff and all this is what these guys create. They didn't go out and create a software package like Bill Gates. They went out and created music. It's the same thing. Just like Microsoft Word is and Windows is an intangible product. Nobody hollers about that. But music, you know, they want to holler and scream about that. So I just had a lot of fun going back and forth with this guy.
Well, you know, I mentioned to you after I read that I agree with his viewpoint in a
mm-hmm.
sense, and in the context of what we've already talked about,
mm-hmm.
About the agenda of the big music labels and how they view their business, and really they see themselves as gods.
Right.
They don't see themselves as someone who is being blessed by talent that can impact their career and impact positively the lives of other people. It's how much money can we get for this?
Right.
It's all about the bottom line is the dollar, and there's no empathy for what a musician goes through
right.
to learn his craft and to maintain his craft and then to fulfill the rigorous, sometimes insane schedules of concert tours and public appearances,
right?
That they want them to follow, and that's leaving out the mind control aspect of it, you know, because they will take someone out in the public arena, way up out in front, and literally make them an Illuminati tool or an Illuminous tool.
Mm-hmm.
They did that with the Beatles. They did that with the Rolling Stones. They did that with Elvis Presley. And many, many other artists, Barbara Streisand, and you know, and I can hear the people now cringing and saying, oh, how dare you say that about, you know, so-and-so. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's a sad commentary. Now, the gentleman, and we could use his first name. I think we're talking about Peter here. The verbiage he used, we wouldn't use on this show.
No, we wouldn't.
But... the visual image of what he described, particularly when he brought up the chainsaw, just cracked me up. I mean,
yeah, that was color. As Mr. Spock said in one of the Star Trek movies, that was a colorful metaphor. In fact, just about every other word that Peter used were colorful metaphors. But I have had colorful metaphors used against me so long I've been online now. It's my 11th year. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I educate and I instruct through my newsletter, but I stopped going on discussion lists for this very reason. Because there's always somebody there waiting to pick a mirage with you, if you will. They're waiting on you. They're waiting when you come in the door. They're looking at you, and you just say one thing out of context that they don't agree with, and there it goes. You've opened yourself up with a big sore. And so I actually got tired of it. Now through the years, since I've stopped going on discussion list, what I do have is I'll put my articles out there, and they'll go out through my newsletter, and then I'll go post them around, and that's all I do with discussion lists is post notices of new articles. And I will just get somebody like Peter out of the clear blue from a 45-degree blindsiding angle that I wasn't even expecting. And, you know, that article that I wrote called Count Your Blessings was not derogatory to anybody. Basically, it was saying, hey, appreciate the fact that you're in a career that you actually like, because most people in the world, I believe, at least in America and I think in the world, are working at jobs that they never ever planned on working at.
Mm-hmm.
They just get caught up. They get caught up in life, basically, is how you can generalize it. And within life comes the bills, the house notes, the car notes, the kids, and all that. And you end up doing what you have to do instead of what you love and want to do. You know? And then you end up and I always thought that was sort of backwards, but it is very strange how to do what we really, in a capitalistic society especially, to do what we really want to do, it is 10 times the fight than if we just were assimilated like the Borg in Star Trek and just go on and go with the flow, and that's what most people do. They go with the flow. They react. They're told what to do every single day, every single minute of their life, every day. And I have never been that kind of person. In fact, that's why I didn't stay in the Army, because of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't stand. No, you know, to that, and I like keeping a schedule, and I like keeping time in music, obviously, but that is just a little bit too rigorous for me. Just every second I know what I'm doing, I know where I'm going to be, and all that. I even know when I'm sleeping and when I'm waking up. That is just too much.
Yes.
But
there's no spontaneity, and there's no adventure.
No, and there, and hence there's no enjoyment.
Yes.
There's no enjoyment.
Well, Peter's communication to you, you know, I ascertained was basically a rather unfair appraisal of yourself.
Yes, it
from
was.
From what I knew from having spoken to you the short time that I did, I immediately recognized something in you that was worth sharing on the, not just on this show, but on many others. And so he was lumping you into a category. You see, you were someone that had achieved a modicum of success through a discipline, through a plan, and that was totally foreign to him. You could not vibe on his level, according to him.
Well, see, basically, Peter had, you know, as we read down into the letter, we realized that Peter had now chosen a different vocation. And he basically gave us the thumbs up, but not in a positive sense as Siskel and Ebert used to do. It, you know, told us to where we could go and what we could do with ourselves. But basically, Peter has just turned his back on the music industry, and that's unfortunate. I mean, I understand a level of frustration, but that is just over the top. And like you said, he lumped me into that barrel with everybody else. I'm quite sure there was somebody out there. You know, I was turned down by the record labels repeatedly. You know, repeatedly. I mean, that's just part of the process. And if you know the industry, you know you're going in there. Very few people go in there and hit it right off the bat the first time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like it's a badge of courage to get your character assassinated by the major labels coming through saying no. You know, we don't like this. Send us something else, maybe. Don't call us. We'll call you. No, we won't call you. Forget about it. You know, but Peter has just taken it 2-4. You know, I'm just hoping that he's not sitting back contemplating anything worse. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, we're already out of time. Believe it or not, Kenny.
Wow.
But this has been an interesting discussion, and I want to invite you back soon. And I want to take that opportunity to have you read some of your work. In fact,
okay.
I was going to ask you for permission to post some on my website.
Oh, that'll be great. That'll be great. Can I also ask before we go that anybody who is out there and has a MySpace, if they would love to join me as a friend, I would love to have them as a friend. That's what we do on MySpace.
Sure. Give your address out if you.
Yeah, it's myspace.com, and then behind the forward slash, it's Jazzman795. Jazzman795. And
okay.
So they just come over there and send me an add request, and I'll be glad to add them on.
Okay. Now you're doing some other things too. I know that you've got music projects that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And your marketing groups and
yeah.
You got a label and everything.
I'm actually one of four principals owners of a label in Houston right now called Eartastic Records, and that website is www.eartastic.com. We're working with signing groups up that who have just music files lying around and don't plan anything to do with them. We're going in and doing the digital promotion worldwide for them. I'm a fiction writer, as I mentioned earlier. I've got some projects on my MySpace site that people can go over there and read, some fairly humorous stuff, some serious stuff, being a novelist and a playwright and all that kind of stuff. So if they go to my site, they'll get everything about me and more, probably too much. just go over there and have fun and read all about me, and I'm glad to share it with people.
No, it's I spent some time there myself. I've been very busy the last couple of days, but you know, from the time we first talked, I went there right away, and I didn't want to leave, but I had to because of other obligations. But I will go back, and if I can, I'd like to post some things on a new page that I'm creating on my site.
By all means, please do. I appreciate it.
And will you send me some music so the next time you're on, we can play some stuff live over the radio?
I'm going to tell you what you may get a kick out of. I was telling you about the Vampire Love. I wrote Vampire Love. I put on my site, I said, you know what, I had this midlife crisis, and I come up with this song that sounds like a new Thriller from Michael Jackson, sort of. That's what it reminds me of. It's called Vampire Love. It's a kind of just a little stupid Halloween holiday song. But it's interesting, too, at the same time, because we actually used really good chord arrangements on it. It wasn't just, you know, a laid-back. It was a combination or hybrid of a rap and jazz and all that kind of stuff. If you can even imagine that potpourri of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in there, and if people want to take a listen to just pull up Vampire Love and Kenny Love on Google and everything, and it's over on iTunes, and you can go over there and listen to it, and AirplayDirect.com has it, and it's kind of an interesting little song. It's basically a song about a guy in love with a vampire, female, obviously, vampire, and she's trying to bring him across and embrace him, and he's sitting there, and it's really kind of a little fun song. It got a lot of promotion from radio jocks, and they really loved it, and club jocks, they really liked it a lot, and so we're hoping to have that come around every year, so to speak.
Now, I listened to the tune. It is kind of catchy, too.
Yeah,
I was wondering if the vampire was a banker or not.
you know, I never thought about that, but I'm quite sure I can find some bankers who have teeth that are too long in the gill.
All right, well, Kenny, we're going to have you on again soon, and you know, I want to help you get some of your stuff out. I think folks would really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah,
and,
that's great.
And the music thing is real important to me too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, as you well know.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we may be working on some things together here.
That'll be great. Yeah, I'd enjoy that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, it's my pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm sure our listeners enjoyed it. The show gets archived, so it will be up on my website, directlightproductions.com, in the very near future, as well as on bbsradio.com.
Okay, great.
And you know, I'll make sure you have a link so people can find it on the network too.
Okay, that'll be great.
Thank
you so much.
And we'll talk soon. In the meantime, folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Our guest this evening, Kenny Love, musician, author, and we could say producer extraordinaire from Houston, Texas, will be with us again in the near future. So be watching our radio schedule. You can see that also on my website, directlightproductions.com. And thanks for being with us tonight. And tomorrow night is our regular Friday night guest, Mr. Jim Murray. And we're going to be talking about some universal anomalies that are occurring as we speak. So you don't want to miss tomorrow's show. Special shout out to Karen. Thanks for the photos, Karen. And Bill and Bob. Also David Crenshaw, Zachariah, Sheila, Sylvia, and Jill, and the general, all the folks with Project Alliance. We want to wish you the best. And I've got a laundry list of names that I have to read off. I'll try to do that on tomorrow's show. Special thanks to everyone who's been sending me their new research, helping me sort of plug up some gaps in my own research. And also want to thank all the folks that have been calling in. We didn't take any calls tonight, but we may do that tomorrow night. So be sure to tune in. In the meantime, I want to wish everyone peace, love, and light. And special thanks to Don Newsom running the board tonight. And have a good night.